Greetings, everyone, and welcome to the Law Hour. The Law Hour is sponsored by the Gordon Law School of Isabella, Missouri, as an educational service in the public interest. I'm your host, George Gordon. And the Law Hour is heard nationally on KU Band Radio at Telstar 5 over North America, and we're on worldwide on the Internet 7 days a week. Now, for more information about the Law Hour and the Gordon Law School, please go to my website. That's georgegordon.org. Again, that's georgegordon.org. The Law Hour brings you important information about law news and current events, so stay with us for tonight's special report on the national debt right after this message. You know, if you're earning $50,000 a year and you pay all of your 14 taxes, you get to keep 41% of what you create and produce. Government gets 59%. That's about $20,000 for you and $30,000 for the government. Now, isn't that just real special? And if you think your share isn't enough for you, then why don't you work twice as hard, produce twice as much, and make $100,000 next year? Now go ahead and pay your same 14 taxes just like you did this year, and you're going to net 24%, and the government will net 76%. Which means that for working twice as hard and producing twice as much, you'll net $4,000 more. That's an 8% net take-home pay increase. For producing 100% more, you get to keep 8% of it. Now, there ought to be something more intelligent for you and I to do than to work to put ourselves into the top 5% of income earners and then only net 24% of it. Why don't you call today and order my free 4-hour CD package and let me tell you how to deal with that kind of crime. It's 4 hours of entertaining information, and it answers many of your legal questions about taxes and why it is that we pay so much for so little received. And let me teach you how to do just that in my Tax and Status School, which is now available on compact disc for adult homeschooling. To order your free general law CD package, you can call direct 417-273-4967. Or if you're online, go to the email and click on to the email machine. The email address, or the website address, I should say, is georgegordon.org. Then click on to the email machine and send me an email request for your free general law CD package. All right, let me do that. And again, that's georgegordon.org. Click on to the email, send an email request, or call direct 417-273-4967. A fellow by the name of Sheldon Emery wrote a small book called Billions for the Bankers and Debts for the People. One of the subjects that he brought up in his book was the national debt. Listen to some of these statistics here, and we'll take a look at money and money policy and our national debt. In 1901, the national debt of the United States was less than $1 billion, and it stayed at less than $1 billion until we got into World War I. Then it jumped to $25 billion. Well, between 1918 and 1941, on the eve of World War II, the national debt just about doubled from $29 to $49 billion. Then between 1942 and 1952, the debt went from $72 billion to $265 billion in 1962. It went up to $303 billion. 8 years later, in 1970, it was $383 billion. Between 1971 and 76, it rose from $409 billion to $631 billion. Then at the end of 1977, it topped $800 billion. During the Reagan years, it topped $1 trillion. Today, in 2004, it tops $7 trillion. And the budget deficit for the 1 year, fiscal year 2004, while projected to be about $550 billion, the real numbers are expected to hit closer to $1 trillion. And that's your national debt. And that's caused by something. Something happened here. In 1900, we had $1 billion worth of debt, and today, 100 years later, we've got a $7 to $8 trillion debt. Money is practically worthless. It's lost 96.5% of its purchasing power, or put another way, it's lost 96.5 cents of purchasing power over what it had in 1900. Now that's pretty significant, wouldn't you say? A $20 gold piece or a $20 bill in 1930 would have bought you a Hickey Freeman suit and wingtip shoes with suspenders, shirt, and tie. Today, that same $20 gold piece will buy you that same Hickey Freeman suit, wingtip shoes, suspenders, shirt, and tie. But that $20 bill probably would not buy you the necktie. Now, that's called inflation. Americans today are used to inflation. We were born in inflation. We have been raised through inflation. We participate in inflation. We all know about inflation. We accept it. It's just a part and parcel with doing business and living life. Inflation is a theft. The national debt is a theft. But you can't prosecute people or hold them responsible for thefts if you yourself participate in the theft. Equity's doctrine says that you can't come to equity with dirty hands. So if you're going to come to equity as a participant in the theft itself, then you can't complain that you've been stolen from because you're a part and parcel with it. We say that you're an accessory before the fact, or you're an accessory after the fact, or you may be an accessory both before and after the fact. Now, you do not have to deal in paper money. You can deal in gold and silver. You always have had that option. There was a period of time when everybody dealt in gold and silver as a matter of public policy from 1900 to 1933, and then we dropped gold, and then in 1965 we dropped silver. You could have maintained a gold and silver standard had you desired to, but nobody did. Today we have our gold and silver back. Only 5% of the people in the United States own 100% of the gold and silver that's in circulation. That's pretty significant. 5% of the people have 100% of the gold and silver. The other 95% of the people in the country are landless peasants who do not own any gold or silver. They don't have any money with which to conduct business. Now, they can participate in public business, in the national economy, but they can't participate in private business outside of the national economy, and I think that's something worth discussing. Now, there are three types of conquest. History reveals that nations can be conquered by the use of one or more of these three methods. The most common use of conquest is by war. In time, though, this method usually fails because the captives hate the captors and rise up and drive them out if they can. Much force is needed to maintain control and to making it expensive for the conquering nation. Now, a second method is by religion, where men are convinced that they must give their captors part of their earnings as obedience to God. Such a captivity is vulnerable to philosophical exposure and change or by overthrow of armed force, since religion by its very nature lacks military force to regain control once its captives become disillusioned. And the third method can be called economic conquest. It takes place when nations are placed under tribute, without the use of visible force or coercion, so that the victims do not realize that they've been conquered. Tribute is collected from them in the form of legal debts and taxes, and they believe that they're paying it for their own good and for the good of others. Or to protect all from some enemy, their captors become their benefactors and their protectors. Now, if we take a look at the United States today, we Americans send money to Russia. We have given most favored nation or trading nation status to Red China, our former enemies, during the Cold War. And then we were told that we won the Cold War. The Berlin Wall came down. That was the symbol that the Cold War was over and that the Americans won. No, just the opposite is true. You see, the Cold War was an ideological war, not fought with bullets and bayonets. It was fought with economics, propaganda, ideas, politics. It was a war of brainwashing. It was a war of psychopolitics. And the Russians and Chinese won the war hands down. And the wisest thing they ever did was to tell the vanquished that they were the victors. And the vanquished are paying to the Chinese and the Russians billions of dollars a year. You see, most favored nation trading status takes $550 billion a year out of America and gives it to the Russians and the Chinese, the Japanese, and a whole host and plethora of others of our enemies, people who have never at any time acceded to our Christian philosophies or our political ideologies. In fact, if you take a look at the 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto espoused by the Chinese Communists and the Russian Communists, we Americans have accepted and practiced all 10 planks to the Communist Manifesto, such as public schools for all children, or free public education for all children in public schools. And the fifth plank, the central bank, the second plank, the income tax. You see, we've adopted their political ideologies and philosophies, but they have not accepted any of ours, such as the 10 principles of the Bill of Rights, you know, like free speech. You don't have free speech in Israel. You don't have free speech in Russia or China. And you don't have free speech in America. Today we have laws that prohibit hate speech. These are direct attacks on the First Amendment's right to free speech. My point is simply this. The Cold War is over. It's done. The Russians and Chinese won hands down, told us we won, and we're paying them tribute. And that's where the bottom line is. And now we're fighting their proxy war in Iraq. We're over there bleeding. We're over there paying. The Russians and the Chinese are over there collecting. So history reveals that nations can be conquered by the use of one, two, or three different methods: war, religion, or economic conquest. And although this is the slowest to impose, that is economic conquest, it is often quite long-lasting, as the captives do not see any military force arrayed against them. Their religion is left more or less intact, and they have freedom to speak and to travel. And they participate in elections for their rulers. Without realizing it, they've been conquered, and the instruments of their own society are used to transfer their wealth to their captors and make the conquest complete. In 1900, the average American worker paid few taxes and had very little debt. Last year, payments on debts and taxes took more than half of what the average American earns. So is it possible that a form of conquest has been imposed upon our people in America? Well, let's read the following pages, and then I'll let you decide for yourself, and may God have mercy on his once debt-free and great nation, the United States of America. Now, that was a little story told by Sheldon Emery back in 1977, and I thought that's a good place for us to start, because when money comes into circulation today, it's borrowed into circulation. That means that you have to sign a promissory note. You go to the bank and you borrow $10,000 because you want to buy a car, you want to buy a big screen TV or a house or something. You sign a promissory note, and you promise to pay interest plus the principal back over a period of time. You become a debt slave. I don't know why you don't wait until you have the money and pay cash so you don't have to pay any interest, but you can't wait, and so you have to have it right now. It's the American way. This money comes into circulation, this $10,000 comes into circulation by simply writing checks. The bank gives you a checking account, hands you a little book, and you got a limit of $10,000, and you go out and write these checks for $10,000. This money came into existence through usury and debt with no labor. Now, the system that God designed is predicated upon thou shalt not steal, and you shall not have an unjust weight or balance in your bag. So you have a law that says thou shalt not steal, and then we have a statute prohibiting unjust weights and balances. Just weights and balances deal in property. Property are the tangible products. It can be labor. That's tangible. It can be a cow, a dog, a horse, a tractor, a car. It can be a farm tool. It can be gold or silver, but it's got to be some form of property. Paper money comes into existence in this way. The Federal Reserve orders the Bureau of Engraving and Printing to print up a $1 bill, and it costs 3 cents. So when the Federal Reserve spends it, they make a 97-cent profit. They can take the same 3 cents and have the Bureau of Engraving and Printing print up a $100 bill, a $500 bill, a $1,000 bill, or a $10,000 bill, and it still only costs 3 cents to print it. That's the paper and the ink. It goes into circulation, and the people of the United States become the surety guarantors of that credit in circulation. For instance, how would you like it if I wrote up a promissory note for $10,000 and had you sign it and pay it back while I go out and spend it and enjoy the fruits that come from it? Because that's what the Federal Reserve is doing. The Federal Reserve, in short, prints up these bills, spends them, takes all of the profit, and you get to pay the bill. Worse than that, you get to pay the bill plus interest. It's not a very good business deal. It's not exactly clear why you want to do that, but I suspect that you didn't understand how that game is played. Then, that money that's borrowed into circulation by your federal government goes on the books as a debt. It's a debt to the Federal Reserve. That $7 trillion of debt that we owe is owed to the same Federal Reserve system. 13 families, 13 stockholders of the Federal Reserve Corporation. Not a very good deal for Joe Sixpack and Sally Housewife, but that's because we didn't want to obey God and keep His commandments. Now let me describe how God mandates that money come into circulation. It's very simple. You go out and go to work and dig gold, silver, or you plant wheat, or you create wealth through your labor out of the ground. All wealth comes out of the ground. And you take that wealth that you create and produce out of the ground and you trade it to somebody else, and he gives you something that he has produced out of the ground. A fisherman could go out and catch fish, and you could climb a tree and pick bananas. At the end of the day, he trades you some fish, you trade him some bananas. Now both of you have fish and bananas to eat. Third person comes in and he grows vegetables. At the end of the second day, you've got fish, bananas, and vegetables to trade among yourselves. Your standard of living is going up. Everybody is producing real wealth. At the end of the fourth day, another guy joins the trading club and he produces fruit. Now you've all got fruit, vegetables, bananas, and fish to eat. Then another guy joins up, and maybe he's a carpenter, and he goes out and starts building huts. Now you've all got a hut to live in, bananas to eat, fruit to eat, fish and vegetables to eat, and a hut to live in. Everybody here is producing real substance. Everybody here is prospering. Everybody here is making profit. Everybody here is learning to live better through labor. As we get a little more sophisticated, we might want to put in a monetary system. A monetary system is based upon property. So we have a gold miner comes into the club, and he goes out and digs gold out of the ground. He trades gold, which makes beautiful jewelry and can also be minted into little round discs and traded for fish, bananas, huts, vegetables, and fruit. The gold miner has now come into the trading group, and he produces something of substance, something that's beautiful, something that's tangible, something that you want, something that you desire, something that you can wear, something that you can use. You can use it in little discs to trade for fish, or you can, the guy that takes the little discs for fish can then use it to trade for bananas and so on. Now, another guy comes into the trading group and he's called the banker. The banker comes in and says, you need me in your trading group because I print paper that takes the place of the gold discs. And it gives you a place to store these gold discs because we have thieves that might come in and break up and steal your gold discs. But the banker can make these paper dollars in place of the gold discs with little or no expense. For every gold disc, he can, for 3 cents, make one of those. And if he can persuade us to buy, sell, and trade with these paper notes instead of the actual gold discs, he can trade those worthless pieces of paper for the valuable gold discs, the valuable huts, the valuable fish, the valuable fruits and vegetables, the valuable bananas, and in time, the banker, who produces nothing and consumes much, will ultimately own everything, including us. And that's what happened.